the sun and the wind and rain, bring everything we need. Father sky above, Mother earth beneath, peace on earth, peace on earth, peace on earth. Sisters and brothers all around the round, we lift our voices high in one joyous sound. Peace on earth, peace on earth, peace on earth, peace on earth. Sun and the wind and rain, bring everything we need. Father sky above, Mother earth beneath. Peace on earth, peace on earth, peace on earth, peace on earth. Sisters and brothers all the world around, we lift our voices high in one joyous sound. Peace on earth, peace on earth, peace on earth, peace on earth. Peace on earth, peace on earth, peace on earth, peace on earth.
One more time.
Peace on earth, peace on earth, peace on earth, peace on earth.
Thank you.
Stay. Well, today's story is Yertle the Turtle by Dr. Seuss. And did you know that Dr. Seuss's birthday was on Friday? So we're celebrating him today. So, on the faraway island of Salamansod, Yertle the Turtle was king of the pond, a little pond. It was clean, it was neat. The water was warm, and there was plenty to eat. The turtles had everything that the turtles could need, and they were all happy, quite happy indeed. They were, until Yertle, the king of them all, decided the kingdom he ruled was just too small. "I'm ruler," said Yertle, "of all I can see, but I don't see enough. There's trouble with me. With this stone for a throne, I look down from the pond. If I could see higher, how much greater I would be. What a king I would be, ruler of all I could see." So Yertle the Turtle lifted his hand, and Yertle the Turtle gave a great command. He ordered 9 turtles to swim to his stone. He made each turtle stand on one another's back, and he piled them all up in a 9 turtle stack. See them all stacked up? And then Yertle climbed up and he sat on the pile. What a wonderful view! He could see for almost a mile. "All mine," cried Yertle. "Oh, the things I now rule. I'm king of a cow and king of a mule. I'm king of a house And what's more beyond that, I'm king of a blueberry bush and a car. Oh, I'm Yertle the Turtle. Oh, marvelous me, for I am the ruler of all I can see. And all through the morning, he sat there up high, saying over and over, a great king am I, until long about noon, he heard a faint sigh. And down on his throne, this plain little turtle looked up and said, beg your pardon, King Yertle. I've got pains in my back and my shoulders and knees. How long must we stand here, Your Majesty, please? And it was this little guy on the bottom. Can you imagine how heavy that was? Whoa. Silence, the king of the turtles barked back. I'm king. And you're merely a turtle named Mac. You stay in your place, and I'll sit here and rule. I'm king of a cow and king of a mule. I'm king of a house and a bush and a car. But that isn't all. I'll do better than that. My throne shall be higher, his royal voice thunder. So pile up more turtles, about 200. That's a lot of turtles. So here they're all coming. Turtles, more turtles, he bellowed and brayed, and the turtles way down in the pond were afraid. Whole families of turtles with uncles and cousins, and all of them stepped on the head of poor Mac. One after another, they climbed up the stack. Then Yertle the turtle was perched up so high, he could see 40 miles from his throne in the sky. Hooray, shouted Yertle, I'm king of the trees, I'm king of the birds, and I'm king of the bees. I'm king of the butterflies, king of the air. Ah, what a throne, what a wonderful chair. I'm Yertle the turtle, oh marvelous me, for I am ruler of all I can see. Different pages here. For again from the blow in the great heavy stack came a groan from that plain little turtle named Mac. Your Majesty, please, I don't like to complain, but we turtles can't stand it. Our shells will crack. Besides, we need food. We are starving, groaned Mac. You hush up your mouth, bellowed the mighty King Yertle. You've no right to talk to the world's highest ruler. I rule from the clouds. Over land, over sea, there's nothing that's higher than me. Uh-oh. Meanwhile, he was shouting. He saw with surprise that the moon of the evening was starting to rise. What's that? Shouted Yertle. Say, what is that thing that dares to be higher than Yertle the king? I'll call some more turtles. I'll stack them to heaven. I need about 5,607. That's a lot of turtles. But as Yertle the turtle lifted his hand and started to give his command, that plain little turtle, whose name was just Mac, decided he had enough, and he had. And that plain little turtle did a plain little thing. He burped. See him burping? And his burp shook the throne of the king. Uh-oh. And Yertle the turtle, the king of the trees, the king of the air and of the birds and the bees, the king of the house and a cow and a mule. Well, that was the end of the turtle king's rule. For Yertle, the king of Salaman Sod, fell off his high throne and fell plunk into the pond. There he goes, head first. And that was the great, today the great Yertle, that marvelous he, is king of the mud. That is all he can see. And the turtles, of course, all the turtles are free, as turtles and maybe all creatures should be. Thank you all for listening.
Friends. And today when we sing the children out, we will sing a reprise of the music we heard earlier. And in case you don't remember the words, they're in the order of service. Peace on earth. Got it? At this time, we'll hear from Tim Fuller. He'll give us a testimony of his experience here at LCUUC and the importance of giving to our capital campaign.
Good morning. Hello. You can hear me now. My name is Tim Fuller. My job here is twofold, really. I want to tell you a little bit about myself and my history with this church and Unitarian Universalism in general. My family joined Church West in Brookfield in 83, I think, or something. I don't know. I can't remember the dates too well anymore. I'm getting old. Shortly after that, I was placed on the building committee for UUCW, and I didn't know what I was doing. I had no clue, and they went through a capital campaign and built a fairly large addition to the church, and they have since grown to be, they were small at the time, maybe 100, 150 members, and right now they're around 300, I think. Running two services with two ministers and an assistant pastor. And then shortly after that, I was elected president. So my history with Unitarian Universalism goes back a bit. It's not as far as some of you in this room. When we moved out here, it was contentious, but it was an important step as far as my family was concerned and many of the families that are here today, just in terms of the distance that we had to go. And we thought this was a good move. And so far it's turned out way beyond my expectations. And so I'm very happy about that. We are now obviously in the middle of a capital campaign to add on to this building, but to make some needed upgrades. And the drawings are out there in the foyer. The chart with the little thermometer is out there, so you're welcome to take a look at that and study it. But really what I want to do is thank those of you who have contributed to the capital campaign already. We are on our way. We're doing a good job, I think, of getting that. The committee is doing a good job of putting it together. And I want to encourage the people who have not, and I may be preaching to the choir here, I don't know, but those of you who have not, I want to encourage you to consider contributing and to contribute as much as you can. We all give to this church in a number of ways, and the financial aspect is tough for everybody. I'm not, you know, we all do what we can. So when I say encourage, I want to give you the courage to step up and do the best you can to help this campaign. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tim. Our monthly pledges help us to sustain the work of this church, but the offering we share each Sunday is about more than a financial contribution. It is an opportunity to recommit to this place and these people each week. If you can, please consider dropping even just a few coins into the basket as a symbol of your dedication to this community and to the values of our faith. And again, loose change and bills will go to the Pewaukee Food Pantry this week. Okay. This morning's offering will now be given and received. Thank you for these gifts given and received.
As a community of human hands and human hearts, this is the time in our service where we come together to bear witness to one another's lives. Before the service, you're always welcome to silently light a candle on the candle table, but during the service, we speak aloud. And Christy will light candles for us. If you'd like to share a joy or need us to be with you in holding a concern, please raise your hand and the ushers will bring you a microphone.
This is Jim. If you would light a candle of concern for Barbara Begale, who suffered a small stroke down in Florida this last week.
Hi, this is Bev. Please light a candle of concern for the people of Syria who continue to be bombarded, and the whole thing is so horrific, and it makes me feel helpless. I don't know what any of us can do except light candles.
Thank you. Can we light a candle for Dave Rotz, veteran of the U.S. Navy, heart attack and two kidneys removed. Thank you.
Uh, Hi, this is Tony. Terry and I were just down in Florida visiting in-laws, and my father-in-law is really struggling with, he's 94, and he's got a big challenge, and it impacts everybody, and just a prayer for him, please.
And we light the last candle for those joys and sorrows which we hold deeply, but which have not been named here today.
The Strength of Humility, of Being Close to the Humus, by John Philip Newell. The Quran includes a powerful account of the creation story. When God brings forth humanity from the fecundity of the earth, the divine command to the holy angels is to bow down and honor what has been made in the holy image. The angels bow before Adam and Eve, but the angel of light refuses. He says he will not bow to what comes out of the black molded loam of earth's soil. He chooses the path of hubris, of lifting himself up over the earth, of positioning himself above the other. Think of the excessive pride present in our lives. Think of our individual arrogance, the way we pursue our own well-being at the neglect and expense of others and their families. Think of the hubris of our nationhood, pretending that we could look after the safety of our homeland by ignoring and even violating the sovereignty of other lands. Think of the hubris of religion, raising ourselves up over the wisdom traditions and even trying to force our ways on them. Think of the hubris of the human species, pretending that we could look after our own health while exploiting and endangering the lives of other species. The way of hubris is opposite to the way of Jesus, who taught the strength of humility, being close to the ground from which we and all things come. Not that the path of humility is straightforward. Constantly there is tension, the tension of discerning how to love our neighbor as we love ourselves, how to honor the heart of another nation as we honor our homeland, how to revere the truths of another wisdom tradition as we cherish our own, how to protect the life of other species as we guard the sanctity of our own life form. The 12th century teacher Hildegard of Bingen says, "Arrogance is evil because it pretends that we can be well by oppressing, by exploiting another people to serve our own. It pretends that we can be well by dispersing and breaking down life's oneness into entirely unrelated compartments. And it pretends that we can be well by depriving, by denying to others and to other species what we ourselves most cherish. By way of contrast," says Hildegard, "humility does not rob people or take anything from them. Rather, it holds together everything in love. The way of humility, of reconnecting to the humus, remembers the sacred ground of being within us all, and it knows that we will be truly well to the extent that we love one another." Here ends the first reading.
So why humility? This topic builds on the touchstones topics that we have been discussing since September. The focus of these topics is giving us food for thought on what is the common good. Touchstone suggests that for a just future, we need some agreement on what is good and necessary and just. But I have to admit, the topic of humility had me a bit flustered when I was asked to talk about it. And I struggle with my own issues with the concept due to my sort of my Christian and upbringing. Perhaps some of you do as well. My Christian upbringing gave me this picture in my head that just won't go away, that humility is this egoless self who has turned into a doormat. Added to this picture, I see humility frequently characterized by weakness or even cowardice. And this picture just can't get out of my head. It's awful. And I just can't abide by that description. It just turns into humiliation too quickly. Where is this strong embodiment of humility? And this quest took the two of us into a journey. And I'm going to take you a little bit now into my personal journey into looking at humility and getting rid of this god-awful picture in my head. To start with, I looked into the meaning of humility. I did not want to follow the dictionary definitions as they continued to discuss humility as having or showing a modest or low estimates of one's importance. Instead, I looked at the root and origin of the word, like we like to do in the UUs. Humility shares a common root with the words like human, humane, and humanity. Its Latin root, humilitas, means grounded. It also shares the same root as humus. And as a gardener and an earth-honoring spiritual practitioner, I thought, here was a thread for me to follow. To be grounded and like humus, a fertile component of the soil. The sense of being grounded and its focus on looking outward seems to be in short supply given our current culture. Let's face it, examples of humility aren't exactly getting media attention. We are blasted daily with self-centeredness and narcissism that has elevated people and created a celebrity culture. As a society, it would seem that we have become quite self-centered. This problem is highlighted magnificently in the commencement address that David Foster Wallace gave at Kenyon College in 2005. He says, "Everything in my immediate experience supports my deepest belief that I am the absolute center of the universe, the realest, most vivid and important person in existence." We rarely think about this sort of natural, basic self-centeredness because it is so socially repulsive. But it's pretty much the same for all of us, he goes on to say. It is our default setting, hardwired into our boards at birth. Just think about it. There is no experience you have had that you are not the absolute center of. The world as you experience it is in front of you or behind you, to the left of you or the right of you, on your TV or your monitor or your phone and so on. Other people's thoughts and feelings have to be communicated to you somehow, but you are your own are so immediate, urgent, and real. Think about that. How do we pull ourselves away from being our own center of the universe? It certainly isn't intentional on our part, but it does happen when we find our place in this self-centeredness zone. It's hard for us to be loving and just. How do we keep ourselves grounded and looking outwards instead of viewing the world as revolving around ourselves? We need to take that first step. As Reverend Larson recently reminded us, once one step is taken, it's easier to take the next one. So in my next step of changing my viewpoint and to increase my understanding of humility, David Brooks assisted me. I took heart from the following passages from his book, The Road to Character. The self-effacing person is soothing and gracious, while the self-promoting person is fragile and jarring. Humility is freedom from the need to prove you are superior all the time. But egotism is a ravenous hunger in a small space, self-concerned, competitive, and distinction hungry. Humility is infused with lovely emotions like admiration, companionship, and gratitude. There is something intellectually impressive about that sort of humility, too. Humility is that awareness there's a lot of you don't know, and there's a lot of what you think you know is distorted or wrong. This is the way that humility leads to wisdom. That's because wisdom isn't a body of information. It's that moral quality of knowing what you don't know and figuring out a way to handle your ignorance, certainty, and limitations. And he goes on to say that the people we think are wise to some degree have overcome these biases and overconfident tendencies that are infused in our nature. In its complete meaning, humility is accurate self-awareness from a distance. It's moving over one's life from that adolescent close-up view of yourself in which you fill the whole canvas to a landscape view in which you see from a wider perspective your strengths, your weaknesses, your connections and dependencies, and the role you play in a larger story. Finally, there is something morally impressive about humility. Truly humble people are engaged in a great effort to magnify the best in themselves and defeat what is worse, to become strong in those weak places. They start with an acute awareness of the bugs in their own system. And reflecting on these passages, that picture completely changed for me. And I learned that humility is this ability and strength to quiet our egos and conquer our fears. I learned that it requires us to go into our roots, into our own humus, and more importantly, into our own hubris, and ferret out our weaknesses. It calls us to be worms again and to look into our dirt and root around in that dirt. It then forces us to acknowledge our weaknesses and know when they are triggered and desperately trying to burst forth. Humility requires us to shine a light on our egos and take responsibility for our own words and actions. These actions are not easy tasks. However, humility leads us to the path to loving and just behaviors and a warm heart. And in the end, I understand that humility asks me to be the best me that I can be and know and acknowledge my weaknesses. It all begins with those few small steps into the depths of ourselves and emerging on the other side in balance.
Breathe with me, you who feel sorrows calling across the oceans, calling across the room, echoing in the spacious cavern of your chest. Breathe with me, you who wake with the sun carrying a restlessness to make justice and do mercy. Breathe with me, you who walk humbly accepting that your gifts for the world will be made by you. You, a soft creature who must pause for meals and water and laughter and rest. Breathe with me, you who sing by heart songs of peace, hope, joy, and love this world into a home. Please join me in a few minutes of silent thought, meditation, or the spirit of prayer. The Height of Heaven and the Thickness of the Earth by Lu Aiming. The body of heaven is extremely high, open, round, immeasurable. It is boundlessly vast, covering everything, containing everything. It produces myriad beings without presuming on its virtue, and it bestows blessings on myriad beings without expectations of reward. Whether people are respectful or insincere, supportive or antagonistic, is left up to them. Whether people are good or bad, attractive or repulsive, and whether creatures are violent and stubborn or docile and obedient, they are allowed to be so of themselves without contrivance. The earth is thick, lovely below all else. It bears everything and nurtures all beings. It can bear even the weight of great mountains, and it can endure even the corrosive force of great waters. It tolerates being pierced by plants and trees, and it submits to the tread of birds and beasts. What I realize as I observe, this is the Tao of emulating heaven and earth. If people can be open-minded and magnanimous, be receptive to all, take pity on the old and the poor, assist those in peril and rescue those in trouble, give of themselves without seeking reward, never bear grudges, look up on another and self-impartiality, and realize all as one, then people can be companions of heaven. If people are flexible and yielding, humble with self-control, entirely free of agitation, cleared of all volatility, not angered by criticism, ignoring insult, accepting all hardships, illnesses, and natural disasters, utterly without anxiety or resentment. When faced with danger or adversity, then people can be companions of the earth. With the nobility of heaven and the humility of earth, one joins in with the attributes of heaven and earth and extends to eternity with them. Here ends the second reading. Please rise in body or spirit and join in singing number 352, Find a Stillness in the Gray Hymnal. in a conversation with my mom yesterday, I said, I don't get nervous when I do that up there. And here I am shaky, so maybe that was an overly arrogant statement to make, so bear with me. When Sue Andrews asked me several months ago if I had anything to say on the topic of humility, I thought, sure, I've had my fair share of humiliating experiences. I can certainly recall any myriad of embarrassing moments and talk about how they made me a better, more humble person. Well, much to my relief and likely to your disappointment, it turns out I won't be sharing any of my embarrassing moments with you here today. Because that's not actually what we're talking about. Which for me at 43 is actually a humbling realization. How can it be that I, who hold a BS in communications, do not really have a clear understanding of humility? Well, humility has gotten a lot of bad press in modern times. It should really consider giving the old heave-ho to its PR firm. As we've heard today, the word originates from humus, referring to the nutrient-dense soil that sustains life. And as Lois said, it shares its roots word with the word humanity. Taken literally, to be humble can mean to be aware of our genesis, the earth. It is a part of us, and we are a part of it. Connected to all beings, not separate. Taken figuratively, humility grounds us, gives us perspective. To be humble is to understand our place in our universe in relationship to all others. Gives us a sense of where we sit and how we all fit in the grand scheme of life. What a beautiful concept. Why then is humility such an ugly word in our culture? Why is it synonymous with low self-esteem, meekness, submissiveness? Well, I'm no historian, but the short answer goes something like this. Humility is a virtue. A humble way of life was once the way to submit oneself to God. But by the 18th and 19th centuries, influential minds such as David Hume, who dismissed humility as a monkish virtue not suited for the common man, and Friedrich Nietzsche referred to humility, kindness, and sympathy, for that matter, as a slave morality. Charles Dickens didn't help matters when he came out with Uriah Heep, an insincere antagonist who repeatedly called himself a humble man in David Copperfield. Fast forward to the 20th century. There was the post-war mindset of American superiority that flew in the face of humility. Then the me generation, who favored self-love, self-discovery, self-improvement in favor of servitude or right relationship with others. And now the digital age enables us to do more faster. And we take off running, doing more faster. Climbing over one another to be more, to have more. You can begin to see how the meaning of humility has become distorted, how reverence for it has been lost. It is time to remember what humility is really about. Reverend Susan Frederick Gray says, "It is a call to honor the humanity and dignity of ourselves, of others, and of the earth and all its creatures." Sound familiar? Let me say it another way. It is a call to honor the inherent worth and dignity of every person. It is to respect the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. So for you keeping score, it's first and seventh principle of UUism. And UUs are a humble kind of people, but humility is a really fine line to walk. Sure, we can stand to be reminded that we are of the earth, ordinary, interdependent. But unlike any synonym for the word humble that a quick web search will yield, it does not mean to be quiet. It does not mean to be submissive or lowly. Regardless of today's common understanding of humility, we must remember that being humble does not mean we aren't a great and powerful people. It means we are divine, yet infinitesimal beings in the universe. Joan Chittister is an author and international speaker of subjects on peace, spirituality, and justice for all. She writes, "If the preservation of the globe in the 21st century requires anything of the past, it may well be the commitment of the rule of Benedict to humility." Benedict's world, she says, was much like ours, a disintegrating empire where the benefits of Roman civilization were being lost to inequality, poverty, and social chaos. Saint Benedict responded by calling for privileged Roman citizens to live more humbly. In the chaotic times of about 500 AD, he wrote the Rules of Saint Benedict. It was a book of precepts for communal living that was specific to monks. The rule provides a moderate path between individual zeal and formulaic institutionalism. And it has been the way of Benedictines for over 15 centuries. Chittister's claim does seem urgent in our world today. She says the reality of climate change, with its almost certain human cause, is a case in point. Our overuse of the Earth's resources is endangering our very survival. Hubris, excessive pride, prevents us from acknowledging our limits. Chittister also says, our elevation of the individual at the expense of the relational, our adulation of the markets, and our belief in unlimited economic growth have eroded any commitment to sustainable living for all that may have once existed. The confident rejection of God by new atheists and the overconfidence of religious fundamentalists is another example of hubris. Arrogant certainty regarding the non-existence of God or of knowing the mind of God endanger our common life, closing our minds to possibilities and at times even justifying violence toward each other. In this context, the possibility of a return to humility, carefully understood, might contribute to the reordering of our relationships with the earth, with ourselves, with each other. The 12 degrees of humility, as written in Saint Benedict's rule, is a path to a stronger sense of our place in the universe of wonders. Bear with me here, okay? The first step to a spiritual life depends on the realization that we live in the womb of God, that we need to admit our struggles and accept the inconsequential circumstances of life with equanimity, and to cultivate the kind of internal peace that leads us to live gently with the rest of creation, to tread lightly through the universe, and deal tenderly with both ourselves and others. All right, so if I may be so bold, I'd like to submit that we might rightly think of the womb of God as a place of connection to the earth and others and a God of our choosing, as I've heard Reverend Amy Shaw so eloquently put it. The part that stops me in my tracks is this: live gently, tread lightly, deal tenderly with both ourselves and others. That's what I want. That's the kind of world I want to live in. But how do we do this in a culture that just might have us for lunch if we tread too lightly or interact with others too tenderly? How do we do this if going to live as a monk isn't really an option. Perhaps these words from a Jewish sage are helpful. Keep two truths in separate packets always, and take them out as needed. In the first, for my sake, the world was created. And in the second, I am but ashes and dust. Blaise Pascal said something similar. We show greatness not by being at one extreme, but by touching both at once and occupying all the space in between. I think our work toward humility is to cultivate all the space between individual zeal and institutionalism, between boldness and modesty, discernment and empathy, assertiveness and a keen ear, between productivity and preservation, independence and interdependence, all while respecting each divine, infinitesimal being that makes up our universe of wonders. I've asked Sue to read a poem for us by Benedictine Mary Lou Kaunacki. I think she's on to something here.
I bow to the one who signs the cross. I bow to the one who sits with the Buddha. I bow to the one who wails at the wall. I bow to the Om flowing in the Ganges. I bow to the one who faces Mecca, whose forehead touches holy ground. I bow to dervishes whirling in mystic wind. I bow to the north, to the south, to the east, to the west. I bow to the God within each heart. I bow to Epiphany, to God's face revealed. I bow.
And I bow to the one whose skin is dark, and to the one whose skin is light, and to those who are scarred or wrinkled or pierced or tattooed. I bow to the one whose sexual orientation is non-binary. I bow to the poor, the addicts, and those whose lives have just gotten off track. I bow to single moms and deadbeat dads and foster parents. I bow to the young. I bow to the old and to the sick and the disabled. I bow to those whose views are different than my own and to those who challenge me. I bow to the earth and to its creatures, for they are me and I am them. Peace.
We extinguish this flame, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These we carry in our hearts until we are together again. Please rise in body or spirit and join in singing our closing hymn this week, number 1008, When Our Heart is in a Holy Place, in the Teal Hymnal.
Thank you.
Go in peace. Live simply, gently, at home in yourselves. Act justly. Speak justly. Remember the depth of your own compassion. Forget not your power in the days of your powerlessness. Practice humility. Speak the truth or speak not. Take care of yourselves, for you are a good gift. Crave peace for all people in the world, beginning with yourselves, and go as you go with the dream of that peace alive in your heart. Blessed be.